And we should be live. I am. Can you give us a one in the chat if I'm coming through loud and clear? Yeah, here we are. We're up and running, everybody, isn't it? Oh, it seems like the chat gives you like little things now, like bees or something. So that's nice. That's nice. There's Evola sunglasses. I would make him a mod. I think I will, because he's pretty good, isn't he? How do I do that? Yes. It all gets just too complicated. I'm not a big streamer. Like, I'll figure that out after the show. Welcome back, everybody. And this is the 40th classic movie stream. So we've slogged our way through 40 classic movies. To be honest, some of them weren't exactly classics, but they gave a bit of sort of interest and cultural commentary and whatnot. But yeah, and before I get started, because I saw the chat, and I'm gonna tell a little story about Spartacus, because Spartacus is a movie that I wanted to do since we started this, but because of some of the things going on with it, I kind of chickened out, and we always kicked it down the road, and it was like, maybe we could do it on Odyssey, or maybe we could do it on a special little podcast thing, or... Because it's just shocking, and it's actually cranked up again. The censorship for this, Keith Woods was just booted off. So we're going to have to use a lot of coded language. We're going to have to be careful how we put things. I would say so in the chat as well, because we all know by now. So we can dig into these things without just jumping on the landmines. Anyway, I've been really rude, and I haven't even introduced that we've got a special guest for the 40th Classic Movie Stream. We've got History Bro, Bo Dane of Lotus Eaters is here to join us. How are you doing, friend?
Fine, thank you, and I really appreciate you having me on. Really Great. Honestly appreciate it. I'm a big fan of you and Endeavour and this series of classic movies you've done, so it's a real honour and a privilege to come on. And I love talking about the Late Republic and Spartacus, so it's right up my alley.
Yeah, well, see, I've never pretended to be an expert in anything in particular. So it's nice to get somebody on who's knowledgeable about things that I'm not. And we've got Endeavour on. How are you doing, Endeavour? Are you ready to hit the big one?
Yep, I think I am. I'm excited for this film because it's one that I've wanted to do for quite a while as well. But, you know, the themes of it make it a bit difficult. But and it's also just one that it's, even though there are a lot of subversive themes in the movie, it is my favorite genre. These kind of 3-hour long historical epics from the 50s and 60s. This is my favorite kind of movie. And we've done probably about a dozen or two of these kinds of movies on classic movies. And I always look forward to it. So this should be a good stream, I hope.
There's a lot to get into. That's the thing, is like we were talking before we went live. We're gonna have to divide this bad boy up and how we actually get into it and break it down. And I mean, I've grew up on this. This is if I'd go to my grandmother's or something on a weekend, this would be sort of standard Sunday afternoon matinee epic, or a bank holiday Monday or something it would be on. And it's quite surprising when you watch it again. I watched it again last night. I've been watching this all my life. But it is quite surprising when you look at it and you see the arms getting chopped off and swords going through people's throats. The big black fella having his neck cut. It's quite with a blood spurt as well, which is what normally that's a no-no for Hollywood. So, and which I'm sure we'll get into, some of the dialogue is quite adult as well. So this is an early Stanley Kubrick movie. But it's a bit of an outlier because, and I was looking this up earlier, Kubrick didn't actually like this film very much because Kirk Douglas was the driving force and he got to call the shots. So Kubrick felt as if he wasn't in full, because he was a bit of a control freak around these films. So when we think of the Kubrick kind of oeuvre, Spartacus isn't really included in it. That said, I do think there's a few kind of Kubrickian kind of things you can recognize about it, like the kind of sterile, shiny interiors and that kind of thing, which you see in especially Laurence Olivier's house. It's got that kind of very kind of austere sort of minimalist Kubrick thing that you'll come to see in a lot more of his films later on. So at any rate, it was by, and I'll get this one in straight away. It was Kirk Douglas was the driving force. And which, of course, you don't need to say it. We know that he's got a certain background. So does Tony Curtis in this, and Stanley Kubrick, though usually he gets a free pass from it. What would you say? Is that sufficient for an introduction into the thing there?
I mean, it's also worth saying that Kirk Douglas's birth name was Isor Danielotovich. So, he changed it. If anyone's wondering, so I mean, I think that everyone probably already knows that this is a big theme of the movie. But you can just look at the cast, which I guess, guys, in our sphere, it's something we always do. Every time you go to watch a movie these days, you go to the Wikipedia page and check the early life of the director. And yeah, I mean, you'll find a lot. You'll find a lot of hits if you do that with this movie. But and it's not even just that, but there's a lot of the very subversive themes. Which
yes, it's actually the themes in it. But all right, so I'll go quickly over the storyline, which I'm sure people know. Yeah, it's just the movie opens with Spartacus, who isn't a young man. I mean, I'll just bring Bo in here for a second. He's kind of middle-aged, and it's not like right at the start of the movie, he looks like he's in his 40s. And they make a point of saying he lived out his young manhood as a slave in Lebanon, or where was it? Somewhere in the Middle East. And so he does seem to be a mature man. Is that actually true to the legend?
Well, okay, so just to say a few words about the historical figure of Spartacus then. It doesn't tell us how old he is. If I could say a few words there just on the sources, just straight away. So it just so happens, because this is set in the Third Servile War, which is sort of 73 to 71, roughly, BC. And we happen to have great sources for the first century BC and the first century AD. I mean, it's almost an embarrassment of riches. We've got Tacitus, Livy, Polybius, Appian, Sallust, Plutarch, Suetonius. We've got the letters and the speeches of Cicero, the letters of Pliny, poetry by Ovid and Juvenal and Horace and Virgil, and on and on and on. It just so happens that the light of history is extremely bright in the first century BC if you're in the Roman world. If you go 1,000 years after this, 800 years after this, we've got nothing. It's almost completely dark in terms of literary evidence. However, having said all that, there's not a great deal on the War of Spartacus, or the Third Servile War, as it's properly called. In Appian, that we've got a few hundred words, about four sides in Appian. And in Plutarch's Life of Crassus, we've got a couple of thousand words. And that's it. That's not it. There's other bits and bobs, but they're the main two accounts, right? So it's a few hundred words in total. And it just doesn't say how old he is. I mean, for example, Appian's account just starts like this. Just says, he's not talking about Spartacus before this. He just starts by saying, in Italy, at this time, Spartacus, a Thracian who had once fought against the Romans, and after being taken prisoner and sold, had become a gladiator. So it just starts like, it doesn't tell you how old he is, doesn't tell you about if he's got any friends, like the Tony Curtis character. There's nothing, well, in Plutarch there's a bit about his wife, but there's not this whole character of this woman that Crassus steals. So it's mainly the character of Crassus, who is sort of towers over history. He's the one that Plutarch does a biography on. And the story of Spartacus is just one scene or one event in the life of Crassus. And so we get a bit of detail, but we don't have loads and loads.
So, okay, so Spartacus ends up going into slavery. Is it to Capua in Italy, into the heart of the Roman Empire, pretty much? And then I'll just stick with the movie. And then he's put into a gladiator school, where his kind of, what would you call it, the owner is Peter Ustinov. and he's trained. Gets very well trained. It's quite brutal, and he forms up a kind of bond and a friendship with one or two of the other gladiators. But there's a little thing with that. He falls in love with Verinia, who's a slave girl who also works there. And then Crassus arrives, and because of his dainty ladies and his new appointee, and you get a sense of the political intrigue that's going on. And he's just made his friend, is it Consul of Rome? What is it? Where he's got all of basically he's in charge of the Roman garrison. And so that's we learn that early on. It's very well written. It's very well made in that way, where it kind of draws you into the politics and the scheming as well. Eventually, they have to fight to the death, which he's not very happy about. This demoralizes the gladiators. Then after that, Verinia is sold off during it. And he's kind of the trainer, who's a bit of a bastard, goads and takes a piss out of Spartacus. Spartacus kicks off, drowns him in the broth, and then we're up and running. They're running riot, they're breaking through, they're killing everybody, and the rebellion is at hand. Meanwhile, we then get introduced to Charles Laughton's character, who's Gracchus, who's more, I would say, a bit more of a liberal minded senator. That we'll get into that, because there's a lot to it. And he hates Crassus, that's his enemy. And the upshot of all of this is that Spartacus is going to try and escape Italy altogether. He makes a deal with the pirates. That becomes then blocked because of yet more political intrigue. And there's a big battle. There's a few battles. You mainly see them in the aftermath. A big battle at the end. Spartacus is crucified. Verinia goes off to be under Crassus, but she escapes through Charles Laughton. And then another thing that I forgot to mention was the fight with Tony Curtis, who is also of the same background as Kirk Douglas. And he has become a sort of the spirit of the soul. He's a singer and he's a man of letters. So he has a kind of poetic nature to the proceedings. They're forced to actually, the idea of the death, the fight, is to try and break their bonds of brotherhood, which it becomes inverted. And then Spartacus and watches his wife and his son head off to freedom. And the idea is that one day, in about 50 years ahead, it's heavily implied and coded that there'll be like some new mass movement or even a religion which will demand freedom and the brotherhood of man and all of that kind of thing. That's like the bare bones of the film, would you say?
Yeah, one thing I'd say, it's obvious when you say it out loud, but it's a film of its time, right? And it's 1960. That's quite early on. You know, that's the year Kennedy got in. They're right in the heart of the Cold War, really. It's only 15 years since World War II ended. It's surprising almost that it's not in black and white. It's a really quite old film. And so you can see a lot of the themes, like, I think they're would be like the early hippie or the Beat Generation type things, you know, about being free and stuff. But the Cold War was in 1960 anyway. It's a real thing, right? It's not completely American paranoia. The Soviets, it was only like 7 odd years or whatever since Stalin died. The Soviets really did represent, to the American mind at least, sort of an unfree world, and that they might win. They might win and we'll all be communist slaves or something. I feel like that does come through quite a lot. Like, it's this early proto-hippie type philosophy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is kind of, I mean, we're kind of jumping straight into the politics and everything, but it is a kind of, it's just a few years ahead of the civil rights and a lot. Do you think like the Roman Empire in this is kind of a symbol for the Soviet Union, like?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, one fedora tipping moment I've got to, I'm afraid. It's the Roman Republic still. It's not even the Empire. It's before it's before Caesar or Augustus. You see Caesar in this film, but in reality, he wasn't involved, barely involved in politics at this stage. But yeah, of course, there's some sort of metaphor or allegory that Rome, the power of Rome, is like that of the state, I suppose, America. Yeah, or it could stand for the Soviet Union or something. There's many, many different things you could read into it, couldn't you?
Yeah, one thing one of my buddies from Moscow, he said he saw that we were doing this stream, and he sent me a message and said that the Soviet Union actually put this movie into theaters a couple of years after it was released in America and showed it basically as it was shown. There might have been a couple of minutes edited out, but basically because it was just really good communist propaganda at the time that the Soviet Union just felt totally comfortable showing this in their country because I would say that if I had to interpret the Roman Republic, it's meant to represent America at the time, that this was made at the height of American power. So this was after World War II. So after America emerges from the Second World War, after Britain had taken a beating, after Germany had been crushed, after Europe was left in ashes, America was basically the hegemon. And there was the Soviet Union, but that was kind of a distant, second. So America was the undisputed hegemon at the time. And one thing you notice within the movie with Rome is that Rome, it just looks absolutely beautiful. The architecture, the uniforms, the women, the landscape, it just looks absolutely stunning. But then when you contrast that with Spartacus and his gang of slaves in revolt, they just look dirty and grungy and basically the total opposite. But the message of the movie is that, I mean, I know we're kind of jumping straight into the politics here, but I guess the message I took away is that it kind of is like this refutation of Western civilization in many ways, because it's showing the beauty of something like Rome. It's saying like, well, here is this like unbelievable civilizational greatness here, but all of that is illegitimate because of slavery. All that beauty that you see, well, that's all built on oppression and on on the institution of slavery. And what's interesting is that in the United States at that very time, that exact same narrative was being applied to the United States. So the very people who were making the movie Spartacus at this time in American history, they were working away because America was on the ups and ups. This would have been the time where the American dream was a reality. This was a time where the average guy, average working class guy, could have a house in the suburbs, a wife, a couple of kids, a car. And, you know, he just had life better than anyone could have ever imagined. Anyone would have imagined a century earlier. And then America, this was also at the start of the space race. So it was a couple of years only before America went to the moon. And to anyone who's going to deny that, I'm not even interested in talking to you right now. But anyway, what the message, the meta narrative, which was pushed, was that all of America's, and then by extension, the Western world, because that was applied to the rest of the West later on, it was that all of that was illegitimate because of racism, because it was all built on the oppression of Black people, and that this was only made possible because of slavery. And the American dream is something which has only been achieved by white Americans, and it's not something which is attainable. And this is kind of the sledgehammer which was used to basically destroy WASP power in the United States, to undermine white ethnocentrism. And this is really what allowed this certain ethnic group to move into power, because they were the ones who maintained their ethnocentrism. I feel like the movie kind of plays along the lines of these same narratives, that this civilizational greatness, it might look great, but it's all built on the oppression of this big underclass. And that's why it's a very Marxist movie.
I mean, if you just want to get straight to the brass tacks of it, bearing in mind I'm on YouTube, what you're really looking at is the idea of a universal man under the stewardship of people such as Tony Curtis and Kirk Douglas, I'll put it that way, leading a revolt and a rebellion against European power and European prestige. So in a way, it's woke. Like, it's a woke rebellion. It's all just the same. And it's coded throughout being that way. So the army, it's this kind of mass of proletarians, like scruffs, from all corners of the world, just marching as this like unending mass against the European civilization. And it's right there from the start in the actual gladiatorial arena with when he has to fight the Ethiopian with the trident. And the idea is that we may be of a different race, but we've both got more in common with each other than either of us do with those bastards sitting up there drinking wine, watching us kill ourselves. Like, this is what it is. And that's in it all the way through the film. So it's kind of strange because you can look at it as being this kind of pure Marxist propaganda. Bear in mind, you know, I mean, people like, again, similar background, Rosa Luxemburg and others in Germany after World War One had the Spartacist League, I think it was called. Mm. So this has like got a long, long lineage in rooted in leftist thought. You can even look into the McCarthy era, which spawned the movie in the first place with Kirk Douglas, didn't it?
Well, Karl Marx himself even he said that Spartacus was like a hero of the ancient proletariat, and he called him the greatest man of the ancient world, which I'll get onto later. But let's just say Karl Marx himself was a big fan of Spartacus.
Hmm. Yeah. So it's like rooted in a certain way of thinking and a certain sort of ethnic proclivity. And it's clear who the good guys and the bad guys are in that context. So you won't find it, like, it wouldn't sit well with, say, Middle Eastern politics today. But yeah, it's I'm veering off course a little bit there. What you'll also notice in the actors who are playing on both sides. Look at Charles Laughton, who is actually he's an Englishman. He's from Yorkshire. Laurence Olivier, the same. It's kind of obvious. It wears it on its sleeve. So, like, it is what it is. But in terms of actual, just as a piece of today, you have to call it like media. I think it's wonderful. Knowing that what it is, I can still sit back and I can think this is great. This is. I think the politics is intelligent. I may not agree with it. I may not agree with the messaging, but I think the acting is superb. I mean, even just the chemistry between Kirk Douglas and Gene Simmons, where you've got the love theme, the gentle love theme, and it plays, and you've got the, and you think it feels as if they really do love each other. And I was thinking, this is nice. This is a film which isn't insulting my intelligence. It is preaching at us. But at least it's doing it well. At least it's doing it with some sophistication.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with a few things that you and Endeavour have said. I sort of grew up with it as well. I've watched it many, many times. It seemed to have been on a rainy Sunday or a bank holiday very often, somehow. And of course, there's a few bits in it that are so famous that to the point of cliche or getting parodied all the time. And yeah, despite the sort of the Marxist undertones, or perhaps you might say overtones, I still really like it. As Endeavour said, that sort of genre of films, things like Ben-Hur or Cleopatra, or, you know, if you've ever seen The Fall of the Roman Empire.
That's another one. I know that one. That's another
Christian
one.
Palmer and yeah, Alec Guinness as Marcus Aurelius, like those films. I love them. They're great. I'm always happy to sit through them all the time. And as you say, well, when I first saw it, as a child, I had no idea. Obviously, all the sort of leftist stuff went over my head. I was a child, right? So it's only in later life when you sort of open your eyes a bit and you can see the stuff for what it is. It, as you say, Morgoth, it is right there. Wears it on its sleeve, in fact. It's right there. You mentioned sort of the Spartacist type movements and things. Yeah, if you were to subvert Western society or Western civilization or something like that, and you were to do it, you wanted to do it fairly subtly, to pick the story of the Third Turbine War, Spartacus's war, it's sort of a great vehicle, because the reality was that ancient Rome was a slave society. They had a fantastic number of slaves, to the point where, well, you get the idea, the Third Servile War, there'd already been other wars, slave wars, already. If you have too many slaves, it's a problem, right? So if you were going to pick a story, a narrative, which talked about oppression and things, there is the real precedent of what Spartacus did. So I guess you give some credit. They picked the right thing.
Yeah, there's a bit that I do like. There's a kind of a controversial scene where Lawrence of Olivia, I better say Lawrence of Arabia during this, Crassus is with Tony Curtis, and he does the famous oysters and snails monologue, where he's kind of tempting him into being gay, but he's trying to, you know, he's got the feelers out, so to speak. In my DVD copy, which I've had for about 20 years, for some reason, Olivier's voice isn't in it, and they brought in Anthony Hopkins. They must have cut it out at some point and then put it back in. But what I love, there's a bit after that when he brings him over and he's telling him to look out the window, and you can see there's like a legion of Roman soldiers marching in formation. And he says, like, this is Rome. This is what it's about. And at the end of the day, it's about soldiers and it's about power. And everybody will bow down and obey Rome. And I actually think that's based. I like that. I'm not going to say, oh, that's awful. Oh, you meanie. I think that's fantastic. I'd be glad and proud of that if I was a Roman. But yeah, it sucks if you're a slave, like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of where the subversion comes in, is that it's showing you this, like, this power and might and greatness that is Rome, and saying, well, but you can't have that because it's built on all of this kind of oppression. I just want to say that, yeah, even though, of course, a lot of the themes of the movie are very subversive, I still really love this movie because it feels like such an adventure. You know, one thing I love is when they have actual extras performing the battles. Like, the battles in this movie, they look much more realistic than, or at least they feel a lot more engaging than something in a modern movie where everything is CGI. And you know that there isn't actually a guy there that's, I mean, of course, guys aren't actually getting stabbed in real life, but you kind of feel, you feel the battle a lot more on a visceral level when you know it's an actual actor there than when you know it's just a computer. So, and then I love how all the sets are built. None of it's, they had to actually build these sets. So it's just such a great movie in a technical sense. And it really, it's an entertaining one. And, you know, I will say that the reason that it actually is, it does work as a film of propaganda. I saw it when I was 18. That was the first time I saw it. And actually, just a couple of days ago was the second time I saw the movie. So it had been quite a while. Of course, the Marxism and stuff that I didn't get. And I also didn't get the ethnic stuff about, you know, the people making the movie. But it did really kind of reinforce I guess what you'd call the civil rights narrative, which was the narrative being pushed in the United States at the time about slavery and about oppression. And you see, like, even the scene here, that the idea is that Spartacus and this Ethiopian guy are actually more similar to each other than they are to the Roman elite. You really see the film does give you that kind of feel. So you can see how at its time, it doesn't seem woke today. It doesn't seem like people today might not see this as leftist propaganda, but I can see how someone in the 1960s watching this movie could come away with more leftist ideas after having watched it. I will also say it's also really effective because the propaganda we get today is just an insult to your intelligence. The reason that a lot of this propaganda was good is because it was actually extremely entertaining, which Spartacus is. It's an extremely entertaining movie.
Yeah.
Just quickly say, I mean, there is obviously, there's the undertones of the civil rights movement in America at this time. There's that. There's sort of the cudgel of the original sin of the United States still having slavery and all that sort of thing. Then there's the sort of the endless stain of slavery throughout nearly all of human civilizations and culture going back to the ancient world. But I mean, it is an anachronism because the ancient world just thought about slavery very, very differently to how we do, like today, or even in the 1960s, but certainly today. It's just, absolutely, it's a terrible thing, and there's no redeeming qualities to it, and anyone that makes any argument for it is definitely either insane, certainly on the wrong side of history. Okay, fine, that's how we look at it now. In the ancient world, that's not how they looked at it at all. For example, you've got the classical Athenian age, the 4th, 5th century BC. We've got great philosophers, people like Aristotle and Plato, and they just say, yeah, no, slavery is fine. That's normal. That's how the world should be. That's how the heavens want it. That's how men have ordered themselves. That's fine. In ancient Roman times, a few hundred centuries, a couple of centuries after that, talking 1st century BC here, again, there's no real question that there's something intrinsically wrong-headed or evil about slavery. They never really questioned it in those terms. That's a much more modern way of looking at it. And so, yeah, to take sort of the themes and the conversation being had around civil rights in the United States in the 60s and transpose it onto the story of the Thracian Spartacus in the first century BC, it is quite clever and kind of subtle. It's just as Endeavor said, this doesn't scream wokeness the way a lot of things do now. Right.
There's
no interracial relationship, anything like that. Right. It's just, and there is also, I would say, if I'm going to say anything redeeming, you know, say anything positive about it, there's one bit where you see Spartacus when he's below in the dungeon and he just sort of screams out, "I'm not an animal." Right. That is sort of a universal thing. It's not just about wokeness and civil rights. You know, there's a big part of humans throughout all of history have found themselves in extreme oppression or repression or slaves and things. So that is, there is also that to it, that it still can just speak to you on just on the, on straight up on the level that it is bad to be a slave. There is still that.
Well, yeah. And that's why it's such an effective narrative to undermine the West. It's like, it's by using this kind of moral indictment against Western civilization that all of our greatness is built on this, which isn't entirely true. It's not true that it is, but it's kind of this Achilles heel, which those who we would consider our enemies have really been exploiting for the last, you know, almost century or so. Now, the thing is that, like you mentioned, that slavery was kind of just commonplace in the ancient world. I think that one thing which really undermines a lot of the leftist narratives about someone like Spartacus, it's that, and Bo can correct me if I'm wrong, but it was never his goal to end slavery in the Roman Republic. It was a revolt. Like, so these slaves revolted. They broke out of this compound where they were held. They pillaged a bunch of towns, got a bunch of other slaves to join their revolt. But the end goal was never ending slavery in Rome. Because I probably no one even thought of that at the time. So you also have to remember that, sure, from the perspective of the slaves, yeah, it's bad to be a slave. Why is someone going to join Spartacus's revolt? Well, it's because it's better to be an insurrectionist in Spartacus's army than it is to be a slave, which undeniably it is. However, their goal, it doesn't seem like they were motivated by this kind of moralistic cause for the end of slavery and for equality. It seems more like, you know, that seems more like, at least from what I can gather, Spartacus's army was basically just going around pillaging because, well, you know, it's better to be a bandit than to be a slave. So even the narrative that Spartacus was this kind of universalist brotherhood of man, egalitarian figure fighting for the proletariat, it just seems like upon any kind of analysis, it just seems like it's incorrect. Marxists always do this. They always try to try to push this narrative that the underclasses, as they would say, that they're more similar to each other than they are to their overlords or something like that. But I mean, that what they don't take into consideration is that there are things which matter to people other than simply class and simply economics. So, you know, someone in we talked about this a bit in our stream on the Untouchables last month. So like an Irish guy and an Italian guy who were on the outs in WASP America of the early 20th century. Well, I mean, did they really have that much in common? I mean, these guys had neighborhoods beside each other. They probably their gangs fought each other. They're fighting over power. Like, let's be honest, they have different interests and they're looking for power. So, for example, if Spartacus's revolt had succeeded, I mean, I don't know what the goal even really was. Let's say that in some alternate history scenario, let's say that Spartacus over marched on Rome, and he got all these slaves together and he defeated the Roman army. And I do have to add that my Roman history is not so good, so I don't know how realistic that actually would have been. But he would have just made himself the new emperor. There would have just been a new emperor, a new ruling class. I don't think it wouldn't have been this egalitarian, universalist, classless society like Karl Marx envisions in the Communist Manifesto. And you also see that all these leftist movements, which were a lot more explicit about this kind of thing, none of them actually brought that about. So you can see how something like this, it works. It's very useful for a leftist narrative, but it really just isn't the case. I don't get the sense from the actual historical figure Spartacus that he was motivated by some kind of universalist egalitarian principle. It seems more just like he thought being a bandit was better than being a slave.
No, and I mean, it's my understanding that in the end Spartacus was killed in battle, but Crassus did crucify all the slaves. And what they do hint at in this a few times is that they're kind of like eventually Christianity will come. I mean, this could get you into some really controversial territory. Like this'll annoy some of friends of mine. But you know, there's no way around it that what it's kind of like, well, if you don't like the idea that this is all Marxist sort of messaging, you could say that it was, well, eventually you're going to have Christianity arriving, and it's again the symbolism of the crucifixion and everything, and that will be a universal man. It's a universe, the revolt, the literal revolt of the slaves and the universal man under Christianity and under God that way. I mean, some of the thinkers, somebody like Spengler, would say that socialism is just Christianity but atheist. Like it's Christianity but with God removed. So what if you wanted to go back and you wanted to be particularly like a pagan bro, they would lap this up because they would be saying, here it is. Here it is. Here it was waiting for you all along.
God, yeah. I find those people so goddamn irritating. I'm not going to lie.
Well, but okay, but it's an argument that has to be taken seriously, because you can see here that you can actually sort of do a switcheroo on whether it's Marxist or Christianity.
Well, we know it wasn't Christianity because the people making the movies weren't Christians. But I think it's kind of one of the things that they can kind of make it a bit palatable for WASP America, because you have to remember at the time how Christian the United States was. You know, you couldn't. They still had to work around that. Even if it were a subversive movie, you'd still have to make it something that, you know, like the stuff today doesn't work because it's just a flat out insult. They wouldn't make the movie just as a flat out insult, because then the propaganda aspect's not going to work with that.
Okay, but if most of the people in America were Christians, which is true, and not Marxists, then maybe that's why it strikes them as being morally good.
Why what does? Why being
the idea of a universal man overthrowing the Roman, because that's literally, you know, the idea that there is everybody is in it together, all the slaves and the poor people, what Nietzsche would call like slave morality, and all of that is kind of here in embryonic form in Spartacus. What I'm saying is, look, there's a kind of mode of thinking which I don't sign up to myself that much, actually, but I am putting it out there that you can say that what you're really looking at here is like it's the lines between Christianity and Marxism get kind of blurred. And so if people in America thought this was a great movie and that Spartacus had a moral cause, maybe it's because they were Christian.
But I mean, they were Christian when they had slavery and stuff as well. So they were more Christian at the time than the Puritan times.
Yeah.
I mean, just to say, mention it, it's obviously set, it's pre-Christian, isn't it? It's sort of in the 70s BC. But yeah, of course, at the end, the image of the crucifixion and things at the end, of course, to the American 1960s mind, or to almost any Western modern mind, you can't get away from the baggage that comes with Christ and any depiction of a crucifixion, right? So that's absolutely there. But one thing I'll say, one question Endeavor sort of kind of asked, which I could clear up the real history of it. Yeah, he never was trying to defeat slavery or even overthrow the Roman state or anything. He was running for his life. When the first revolt in Capua, then they break out and they try and go north. They go to the Alps and they get all the way to sort of northern Italy and the Alps. And then they're stopped there by the governor of Transalpine Gaul and they turn back. And then later because his revolt is like two and a half years long. Best part of 3 years long. Another time he finds himself down right in the toe of Italy by Regium. He's just trying to escape. He's not trying to stop slavery or defeat the Roman state or anything like that. He's trying to flee to Sicily, where he thinks there might have another slave revolt there. The first and second Servile Wars were on Sicily. And then he stopped there. He sort of backstabbed there. He tries to go to the heel of Italy and he's stopped there. Lucullus turns up, one of the other great generals of the day. And then in the end, when he's finally defeated, he's still just on the run. Yeah, so it's a completely 20th century thing to impose on top of Spartacus. What we've been talking about, yeah.
What I would say as well, just to kind of round off the politics, because we've spent quite a long time on it, but, you know, is the Joseph McCarthy angle on this and what was happening in Hollywood in the 1950s. And just to keep it short, you can't help but, like, note the irony here where Joseph McCarthy, the idea there was that, okay, we need to start rounding people up. We need to start taking names because there's communist subversives working in Hollywood. And there was a huge outcry. The bit in this where it's like, I'm Spartacus. No, I'm Spartacus. Apparently that's an allusion to how all of these people similar to Kirk Douglas in Hollywood had to remain anonymous, like what I am, or, you know, but then, like, as if, like, in a few years later, in 1960, you have this massive sort of blockbuster comes out, and it's as if it's there to prove McCarthy right. It's as if to say, well, like 5 years before, I was looking on YouTube today. And there's lots of documentaries about how Joseph McCarthy was a demagogue, he was a monster, he was paranoid, he was a conspiracy theorist. And this is like, I think, like 3 years after he died, suddenly, all of a sudden, you've got like this giant Marxist kind of blockbuster comes out as if to say, yeah, well, actually, everything that you thought was happening, it was. And
a movie that the Soviet Union gladly just showed in their own country because they liked the values in it.
I wrote an article a couple of years ago for Lotus Eaters called McCarthy Did Nothing Wrong, where I argued, no, the US State Department and defense structures and Hollywood and publishing were absolutely riddled with card-carrying communists. It absolutely was. No, McCarthy was attempting something righteous and good to try and prevent America from being completely subverted by essentially Stalinists. It's bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing to point out is that I read on the Wikipedia for Spartacus, but so what it said was that Karl Marx described him as the most splendid fellow of the whole ancient world. Which, I mean, that just sounds like a totally ludicrous thing to believe. You mean just tell me that he was better than Constantine or Julius Caesar or Marcus Aurelius or Aristotle or Pericles? Or, you know, I could think of hundreds of examples of more historically important and greater men than Spartacus. He just kind of was this bandit who led a revolt for a couple of years. But, you know, according to this, it's the morality of someone like Karl Marx and according to the leftist morality, you know, the more of a loser you are, the more morally superior you are. So, you know, because Spartacus went around pillaging and, you know, he was going around starting wars and fighting a bunch of people and, you know, stealing people's property and stuff like that. I mean, he wasn't on this moral crusade. It was more just, you know, being a bandit because that's better than being a slave. And you see this morality with leftists all the time, that they'll laud people. You know, another character who came out of this era, it was Martin Luther King. You know, the person who we're told is the, or as I call him, Nelson Luther Floyd Jr. The person who we're told is the secular version of Jesus today, that he's the greatest person ever to live. But then when you look at America today, it's clear that the quote unquote dream, it clearly didn't turn out. It clearly didn't pan out. And you can look at, did communism make Russia a better country? Did the French Revolution make France better? You know, Haiti, another example that leftists love to point to all the time. Today they eat each other. So did their slave revolt actually bring about this utopia? You know, it never, ever actually happens. But what you see with leftists is it's always about ideology. It's always, and you know, in the case of Spartacus, it wasn't even his ideology. It's more them projecting their own ideology onto him. But it's always that this ideology of the universalist, egalitarian, workers' utopia, revolt of the underclasses. It's believing in this ideology is what makes somebody a moral person and not the person's actual actions. It's not the actual positive contribution someone makes to the world. And that ultimately is, I think, how you can sum up leftist morality, including wokeism, including Marxism, including, you know, French Revolution, and whatever it may be. It always goes back to this idea that the dream, or the delusion rather, of kind of this egalitarian utopia, that's always, believing in that is what makes you moral, not your actual actions as a man.
The idea as well of Spartacus's plan is not that they are all going to live together in this kind of harmonious multicultural bliss, but that they're all going to go their separate ways and go back to their homelands, because they'd actually have them. And if you were going to, like, if Spartacus was to become a kind of king of this sort of blob of humanity, you know, it would just be like this sort of despot. It wouldn't, I don't understand how they're supposed to make these systems function, but, you know, it is what it is. Just to clarify, I'm not anti-Christian. I think one of the biggest disasters that ever happened to Western civilization was the loss of the loss of religion. But what I will do is take a certain side just to spice up the conversation from time to time. I've said repeatedly on all the other classic movie streams, and we've got into these kinds of things. I think it was a catastrophe, the death of the church in the West, because I think when people say, well, Christianity made us all universalists, I just don't see that much evidence of it. If you look back in history, like, theoretically it could be true, but if you actually look at the history, it just wasn't the case.
They weren't even universalists with other Christians. They went to war with other Christians, for God's sake.
Yeah, it's. I just don't buy into that. So yes, like, what the critics would say, oh well, it's made of, like, we got cooked by Christianity, and I don't see it. I see the West getting weak after Christianity. Everybody became atheist. I see the opposite happening. So that's my general view on that. I'm not Christian, anti-Christian at all. But anyway, I think, so that's pretty much the politics of Spartacus, because, and this is, when you get into it, it's kind of like, this is what makes it such a difficult movie to analyze, because you want to kind of, you do want to be honest about it. But on the other hand, I don't want to dwell on it for the whole stream either. But if you want to dig into it, you could very well lose your channel because of the direction that this is all heading in. Where in the end it is like the implications of what we're talking about are probably illegal in Britain, when you're talking about the backgrounds of Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis symbolically representing this kind of mass blob of humanity to bring down the West, which I would say Rome is kind of fascist coded as well, in the way that they've done it.
Could I add one other thing? Because there was something that, obviously we talked about the themes of Marxism, but there's something else I noticed in here, and that's actually themes of Sigmund Freud. And again, you know, no need to check the early life section because we all know already with this one. There are a few scenes. So one thing Bo mentioned is I don't actually think it's – he mentioned that there are no, like, interracial relationships in the movie. But there was this one scene towards the beginning. So some of the guests, when they went to see Spartacus when he was still a gladiator and he was forced to fight the Ethiopian, the two of the women who were selecting which gladiators they wanted to see fight, one of them said – the black man, I want the most handsome one, implying that that white women secretly have this deep desire to, have relationships with black men, as the present day advertisement seemed to suggest. But in the 1960, in the America of 1960, that would have been extremely taboo. There's the scene you also mentioned where it implies that Gracchus, it implies that. What was the consul? Was it Crassus or Gracchus?
Charles Lawton is called Gracchus.
Gracchus, yes. It implies that Gracchus is that he's bisexual. So there's the scene where he's in the bathtub and he calls his slave over and he's trying to get the point through to his slave that he's bisexual and that he finds him sexually attractive. There's also the scene where there's the Gracchus character, so kind of like the more liberal senator, the one that's a bit more kind of sympathetic to Spartacus and his revolt. So there's a scene where another guy, I think it's Peter Uzumov's character, he talks about, like, look at how many mistresses you have, and he replies to something to the effect that, well, under Roman law, well, adultery is only when you're married and you you commit adultery against your wife, but I've never gotten married, so there's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. So, I mean, what that also implies is that the institution of marriage is one that's kind of just pointless because everyone's true desires is to have endless sex with whomever they please. And that's kind of, you kind of have some of these undertones. It's not nearly as much as the Marxist stuff, but a lot of this seems like it comes from Civilization and Its Discontents by Sigmund Freud. So, this, and by the way, I will say that I think that I think Sigmund Freud's ideas were even worse than Karl Marx's in terms of just how poisonous they are and in terms of how damaging they are today. I'd say that other than Franz Boas, I'd say Sigmund Freud's ideas were probably the second worst. It's this idea that basically the idea of civilization and its discontents is that unhappiness is the result of civilization putting all of these constraints on our deepest desires, and that it's the expectations of society which make us depressed. And I mean, I won't go into too graphic details because I know we're on YouTube here, but I feel like Sigmund Freud himself is a very perverted individual, and I get the feeling that with him, his entire writing is just about him trying to rationalize why not everyone was actually like him. But you know, this idea that this is what makes people unhappy, I think, has just been proven totally incorrect, because the idea that he puts forward is that things like the family, the nation, law and order, civic duty, patriotism, that all these things are constraints upon us that which stop us from achieving our deep desires for sexuality and whatever else it is. I mean, there's a lot of messed up stuff with that Freud writes, but I find, like, the opposite is true, though, because things like religion, patriotism, the nation, family, civic duty, things like that, that actually is what makes people, that's what actually makes life worth living. That's what actually gives people a reason to live life. When you take that away, they don't feel liberated. They just feel like their life is meaningless and they want to die. So you mentioned the scene where Crassus points out to the Roman army and says that that this is Rome, this is might, this is power. Well, that, I mean, it's meant to be that this is this force of oppression. But you and I think probably all three of us really identify with that. Because it's that kind of push towards greatness. Things like a man's duty to fight for his nation and stuff like that. That's what actually makes life worth living. But you know, with Freud, he basically says it's basically the opposite of that. And you see that theme. The message is that, well, Rome is kind of like this degenerate society where it has all of these vices just bubbling under the surface, and it's all just being held back by these silly mores that they have. And of course, they said the same thing about Christianity. later on. And I will also point out that this is before the myth that we hear today, the idea that everyone in Rome was a homosexual, which is incorrect. Leather Apron Club did a great video debunking that. But in this movie, they're still at the point where they're suggesting that Romans were just latent homosexuals, that they weren't actually just open homosexuals, as we're told today. But yeah, that's another theme I saw in the movie.
I mean, I would like to bring Bo in a little bit, and we'll talk about the rivalry between Gracchus and Crassus, which is in the film, and I'm sure you'll know a little bit about it, where one is a patrician and the other one, what was his demarcation? What was Gracchus?
Right, well, so the figure of Gracchus isn't really that important. Like, it doesn't really come up in the actual histories very much. It's between Pompey and Crassus. That's the biggest rivalry. So in the real history, the most important people in the state at this time, Sulla had already died. Sulla died, the dictator, sort of the undisputed, reigning, defended, sole dictator of Rome. Sulla had died about 5 years before this. Okay, so the biggest players on the scene were Pompey, another general, Lucullus, another sort of slightly older general, Metellus, and Crassus. Crassus is the richest man in Rome. This Gracchus figure is not one of the big players in the actual
history. In the movie, is he supposed to represent something that was going on, or is he just there to be a kind of liberal? You know, they make that point where there's Peter Ustinov and Gracchus are sitting, they're both fat. And he says, I've noticed that the most like horrible of tyrants are thin and we are fat. And it means that we're kind of given to the nice things in life and we don't have mean characters and all of that. But I thought there was something going on, like the politics of Rome, because Crassus is, in the movie, Crassus is, he represents this kind of reactionary almost, harking back to an older Rome. He doesn't like it. He thinks Rome's become too liberal, too corrupt, and he wants it more like a sort of military dictatorship. And Gracchus, he actually says, I'll take a little bit of corruption with freedom and not your tyranny, when he storms out after the debacle of his champion loses to Spartacus. And is that representative, that rivalry, and that, because they've both got different ideologies, was that something I'd play?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Gracchus figure is like a Pompey figure, very much like it, and they were the just rivals for, so okay, where to start? For the last 70, 80 odd years running up to this, the Roman Republic had started to fracture and fall apart with different great men sort of trying to take sole control. This is before Julius Caesar, trying to take sole control of the state. Different tribunes like the Gaius Gracchus, and this is generations before this. And then you had two important generals, Marius and Sulla, having a whole civil war, just one generation before this, a massive civil war where all these people like Pompey and Crassus, they were all involved in that civil war as younger men. And in the end, Sulla wins that civil war, becomes dictator for the rest of his natural life, which isn't very long. Then he dies of natural causes. And then Rome is plunged back into this sort of holding pattern of, when will there be another civil war? When will the next great man emerge to like seize control of everything? And that struggle is between Pompey and Crassus. And in the end, it becomes a three-way struggle between Caesar. Caesar's not really on the scene in the early 70s BC. His career is about to kick off just a few years after this. But about 10, 15 years after this, it's like a three-way thing between Crassus, Pompey and Caesar. And we all know that Caesar ultimately wins to the point where the Republic itself is destroyed and then it becomes a de facto monarchy and an empire. So to answer your question, yeah, there's loads and loads of rivalries. Crassus is just one of, and arguably for a while, the key player in all of that. So it is interesting, and it's great, you know, that the screenwriters, they took this from a novel, didn't they? But the novel is obviously taken from the real histories, Plutarch and things. And Crassus is a fascinating figure. I've got a two-part bit of content on him, just his life, because he is so fascinating. He's one of, if not, well, certainly in the top three most important figures for the end of the Roman Republic. I think he's played very well by the Lord Olivier, first Baron Olivier, He's done very well. There's a reason why he was rewarded as an actor. But I think they got it down quite well. The way when he sort of slaps, he can't take that Spartacus won't answer him at one point towards the end, doesn't he? And he slaps him across the face. Just suddenly angry. He wanted everything. It's not enough that he won, but he has to have him submit to him in real time to his face, and he won't. And that enrages him to the point of violence. Yeah. I think that's quite a good reading of who Crassus was. But there was just one other quick thing that Endeavor spoke about that I wanted to just sort of say or clear up. Just the idea that, last thing to say maybe on the politics side, is that if there's anything at all in the actual history about someone like Spartacus being anything like a Marxist or an egalitarian or anything, there's one thing, there's one line, literally, in Appian, where he says that he, Spartacus, plundered the nearby areas, and because he divided the spoils in equal shares, his numbers quickly swelled, end quote. That's all that's said about it, but, you know, a Marxist novelist or a Marxist screenwriter will take that one line, and subvert it into that Spartacus is now a new man and a leader of an egalitarian revolution or something rather. But go ahead.
I was going to say Crassus. This becomes at the end and it hits Crassus like a double whammy, because what he realizes is that power and wealth and even all of the might of Rome cannot actually crush an idea. And the first time it's when he has Varinia in his home, and she pretty much says, like, I am Spartacus's woman, and there's nothing you can do about that. I always will be that. Now, you can rape me, you can kill my baby, which he doesn't actually threaten to do, but she accuses him of it, which is a kind of nice little touch there, which is, you know, a little female trait. But he realizes that. In order to, he then wants to take that out on Spartacus. He wants to then really crush Spartacus, even the idea of him. And so that's what he heads off to do, because he's becoming increasingly frustrated that it's as if the message is power isn't enough. There are limits. Power cannot crush an idea. Whether it's not in the case of Varinia, it's the idea of love. And what happens when he goes to see Tony Curtis and Kirk Douglas? Again, I kind of get around it, but yeah, they do have bonds which are not really related to power, but group. And he's then confronted with their solidarity, if you want to call it that, the brotherhood of man. And he can't break it. He can't break it, and he loses his rag and slaps Spartacus in this kind of, and then Spartacus just spits in his face with contempt. Then he says, okay, we're going to put this to the test and we're going to make you fight each other to the death. Now, according to his logic, what should then happen is that they kind of fight like rats to save one another, to like be the one who lives, but it becomes inverted. So what they're going to do is the winner will be crucified. So this is what he's trying to do, playing a dirty game on them like that. And then the idea is that they're trying to kill each other to sacrifice themselves. So that bond of brotherhood is like rock solid. If he had said, for example, well, whoever wins will get a villa in Rome, then it would be, I think the stakes would have been probably higher. I mean, I also think I think they would have actually fought. Like, they would have tried, I think it wouldn't have worked. I think they would have tried to kill each other. You would kill your brother, as it were, to get the villa and be free. I mean, you know, it is what it is. I'm a bit more cynical about human nature. But I suppose that's the point. I'm more like Crassus, I suppose. But that's kind of what they're getting at. They're saying, well, this idea of, you see, if the stakes are ethnic and blood, I mean, as they actually are, in terms of Tony Curtis and Kirk Douglas, then I can kind of get it. But if you want to bring in a purely socialist perspective where it's materialism, because that's what eventually it would have to replace this. They'd have to have some kind of grounding in something, and in the end, they settle on just these kind of material realities and who's got more money. In that case, I don't think there would be very much solidarity at all. I mean, look at the left today. I don't see much solidarity. I don't see much in the way of people sacrificing for each other on the left. I think there's a lot more of that on the right, to be honest. But anyway, yeah, I think it is interesting that they put all of these little tropes in there.
If I could say one thing about crucifixion, it's a horror, it's a terrible, terrible, torturous way to kill someone. I mean, you die of exposure in the end, or thirst, or maybe suspension trauma, you know, you suffocate or something. Either way, it's extremely slow and very, very horrible. And the psychological damage of that as well. Imagine the horror of being crucified. Now you're going to be there for 2, 3, maybe 4 days, just hanging there until you die. The sort of the horror of that. And I mean, even in the ancient world, it was considered a harsh execution. And so it really did happen that eventually Crassus defeats the last remnant of Spartacus's army and takes 6,000 of them prisoner and crucifies them all along the Appian Way, the Via Appia, the road, the most ancient, venerable, almost sacred road that leads from Capua up to Rome. 3,000 on each side of the road. Like, can you barely imagine such a thing of horror these days? You can't imagine it. And when I first saw the movie when I was a kid, I distinctly remember at the end expecting them to cut him down, like Peter Ustinov or something, will cut him down at the last moment. Wait, the film can't end like that. Well, he's just going to die on the cross. What? Is that the end? No way. Anyway, I remember thinking that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I should say one last thing, just super quick. You can bounce off of it. Just that that's not how the real Spartacus died. He did fall in battle gloriously with wounds on the front. I could read a line or two if you want. But yeah, he wasn't crucified among those 6,000 in real life.
Yeah, read what really happened then.
Well, okay. I mean, if I read from Appian, he said, then this is the last battle. So there was many battles. Spartacus won 5 or 6 different full-blown engagements, but the final one against Crassus, Appian says, the fight was long and bitterly contested, since so many tens of thousands of men had no other hope. It was either win or die. Spartacus himself was wounded by a spear thrust in the thigh, but went down to one knee, held his shield in front of him, and fought off his attackers until he and a great number of his fellows were encircled and fell. And a bit later on, Appian explicitly says, Spartacus's body was never found. And so to contrast it slightly to Plutarch, he was writing, both these guys are writing a good 150, 170 odd years after the fact. So it's like someone now writing about the Crimean War or something. They're a bit far removed from it, but nonetheless, slightly different account from Plutarch. He says, first, when his horse was brought to him, Spartacus, when his horse was brought to him, he drew his sword and killed it. Killed his own horse, saying that the enemy had plenty of good horses, which would be his if he won, and if he lost, he would not need a horse at all. Then he made straight for Crassus himself, charging forward through the press of weapons and wounded men. And though he did not reach Crassus, he cut down 2 centurions who fell on him together. Finally, when his own men had taken to flight, he himself, surrounded by enemies, still stood his ground and died fighting to the last. So there you go. He didn't die on the cross like in the film.
I mean, it's an interesting change, isn't it? Because in terms of making a movie, that's a fantastic way to go out. And I've, you know, they instead they turned him into Jesus and set the seeds for a future like revolt and rebellion till the bitter end. Because I mean, in fairness, though, his story arc did come to just in terms of storytelling, it is well-made movie. I'm not going to pick faults on it for that reason. It's one thing if you say, well, it's not accurate to the history, which it isn't, and they could have made just as good of a film if he went down like that. It's kind of like, well, then he is just going down in battle, And yeah, okay, what they've done instead is to make an obviously highly symbolic ending, while at the same time, which I do think is important for the story, is that he gets to see his wife and his little baby son for his son, it's the first time, and for his wife, it'll be the last time. And so you do feel like you've reached a satisfying conclusion there in terms of narrative. And then you're all right, though. Like, it's convenient because he just kind of drops to one side on the, even though he looks like he's going to be there for days on end, you think, yeah. Is it like, 2 days later, would he be like howling and kind of puking up and everything like that on the cross? You know what I mean? Like, if you did like a, you know, when they cut a little bit in after the credits start to roll, and then you see Spartacus like 3 days later with Buzzard's pecking his eyes out and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, you would piss and shit yourself on the cross. Yeah, that's one more indignity, one more part of the humiliation. Yeah, and God, yeah. Someone that's been on the cross for 3 days. Can you imagine? Again, the horror of knowing that you're dying there, let alone if they leave them up for weeks afterwards, which apparently is what Crassus did. For weeks and weeks after, there's just these corpses, thousands of corpses lining the road. I mean, it's a health hazard, if nothing else.
Now, is it true that I heard somewhere that Spartacus and his gang, like, either crucified a Roman soldier in their camp or something like that?
Yeah, there's absolutely an account in Plutarch where at one point it's in the Regium campaign, Crassus completely surrounds his camp, builds a 40-mile-long, or is it kilometre? 40-kilometre or mile-long trench to pen in all of Spartacus's army. It's 15 feet wide, 15 feet deep, 40 miles long, and a giant wall built on one side of it. And, in Plutarch, he says at one point, to show his own men what's going on, yeah, he gets one of the Roman prisoners and crucifies him in no man's land. That's the English translation. It says no man's land, crucifies him there. So, yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. In real life, Spartacus would be a terrifying figure. Yeah, he'd come and pillage where you lived, come and steal everything in your village and town and maybe kill you. And his men were completely unruly and uncontrolled. Yeah, completely. He's at odds with the rule of law, Spartacus. Yeah, he's obviously it's a weird Hollywood thing just to make him out to be a goodie, that he did nothing wrong and everything he'd done was morally or ethically cleaner than clean. No, no way. No, he's a brigand and a criminal. He's a criminal.
There's even in the film, there's bits of it where, like, they enter these small, like, villages and provincial towns and they're just robbing the place blind. And you think, well, come on, is this, like, am I supposed to feel... You know, it was like when BLM, like, they were looting all those shops in America and we were supposed to sympathize with, like, BLM. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, this is a bit dodgy, isn't it? Because that's kind of what it is, like the OG BLM movement or something like that, but without the corporate sponsors.
Yeah.
Oh, the corporate sponsors came 2,000 years later.
No, I mean, the actual film and the Hollywood thing, that's okay, that's one thing. But if I was just to talk about purely the historical figure of Spartacus, right? Yeah, okay, he's a Thracian person that has been enslaved against his will and been forced to put up with any number of horrors and indignities. And that's terrible. But also then he took matters into his own hands and murdered and raped and pillaged his way across Italy for a couple of years. Right, I haven't got sympathy for that. Right, I'm not.
Well, I'm not on board
for that.
I think the idea is that, it's about power, because, you know, if you'd rather be the master than be the slave. Obviously, it's a terrible thing to be a slave, but, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot, well, you know, don't expect that person is going to then be this kind, lovey-dovey, cuddly teddy bear. So, you know, with Crassus crucifying all of these slaves who they captured at the end of the once Spartacus's forces were defeated, that's basically him saying that, you know, this is what happens when you cross me. So I have power. and this is what happens when you come across me, and this is what happens when you make me unhappy. And I don't really think that it's fair to interpret that as him being, I mean, it's obviously a horrific thing to do. It would be quite the sight, as you said, seeing 6,000 guys, so 3,000 in a row on both sides of a road crucified. That's a pretty barbaric sight. I would never want to have to actually see that myself. But, you know, because let's not forget that the people that they were crucifying were people who were pillaging it. We're pillaging and everything like that. I don't mean to say that one is more moral than the other. The point is that this is like, it's a struggle for power, and that's how history and really just reality works. So it's not this, more moralistic cause for the universal brotherhood of man. No, it's one person fighting for power versus another person who also wants power. And you always see that even when the people who claim who actually do take up these political revolutions and ideologies, which of course wasn't actually the case with Spartacus. But what you see with someone like Joseph Stalin, well, you know, when he actually does get in power, the results speak for itself. It's not the egalitarian, peaceful workers' utopia with the brotherhood of man living in harmony, singing kumbaya. It's the new boss. It's meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Yeah, one thing I would say definitely is true, to build upon what you're saying there, definitely 100% is true, and the accounts actually go into a fair bit of detail about it, is that Crassus was absolutely trying to make a statement about his power and prestige, because even though he was the richest man in Rome and probably one in the top two or three most preeminent men in the Senate, both Pompey and Lucullus were more senior generals, military commanders, imperators. They both sort of completely eclipsed him in terms of military achievements. So this was sort of his big chance to have a command, win, and be shown to be a great general up there with the likes of Pompey and Lucullus. And so one of those things to sort of stamp that into people's minds is to do this mass crucifixion thing. And so, yeah, he's absolutely making a statement, making an example of the guilty people in the Third Servile War.
I will say, like, which we haven't mentioned yet, but the battle at the end is, I think, the best depiction of like a Roman battle and formation I've ever seen. Like people like the one in Gladiator, but which was probably largely kind of copied off this one, to be honest. I think they got like the whole of the Spanish army or something and dressed them up in Roman uniforms. But what it does brilliantly is that I remember years ago when I was listening to the extras on Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings and the Battle of Two Towers. And he actually mentioned Zulu. It was all about how do you do a good battle scene? How do you make a battle scene which is really like which works in terms of cinema? And he mentioned Zulu, which we've covered not so long back on Endeavor's channel. And on Zulu, you have this huge buildup. There's like an hour of Zulu passes before it all kicks off. But you know, you hear the banging of the shields, and there's this tension, the buildup of tension going on, and they do that again here. Now, earlier you haven't actually seen them in major engagements. It's in the aftermath of battles, which like they might have done for like budget reasons, I suppose. But I think it's worth it because then you're thinking this is different now. They're trapped. It's all victorious for them. For it's as if they've got almost like they're just mowing down all of these Roman legions. But this time, you get the names of the generals and you get on a map, and it's kind of little seeds being planted as if to say, this is going to be different. This time the Romans really mean business. And then when they actually arrive, you see them, you know, all the columns coming, and then they're going along the front and they're moving around, getting into positions. And it's just fantastic. As Endeavor was saying it earlier, it isn't CGI. This is real. That was all these real. That was like thousands of people. And you look at it and you look at the Spartacus and his men, and they're just like one big blob. What was it? Like the sort of the populist delusion type thing. They're against an, or this time that like the populists are against an organized majority. Well, it's a majority, isn't it, this time?
Okay, yeah, that's right.
So you just it builds up and plays just absolutely brilliantly. And I think it's great. Go on then.
Well, this is something I wanted to add quick is that you mentioned that they actually had trained Spanish soldiers. So 8,000 Spanish soldiers lined up for this battle. So considering this would have been during Franco's time, then I guess they had literal fascists dressed up as the Roman army.
Good point.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, on movie like YouTube, everybody's talking about Gladiator 2, and I kind of like it that we've just, you know, it would have been a cheap trick to do Gladiator 1 on classic movies this month, but instead it's just now I'm just not even going to touch it. Let's just go back to the original to Spartacus and not even mention Gladiator 2 at all.
I actually really love it in these old films when they've got thousands of extras. I mean, who doesn't really? Is there anyone out there? It's like, no, I don't like that. I prefer CGI. No, it's great. Like they are once reviewed with Drinker, the 1970 film Waterloo, where none of it's CGI, of course, 1970. And then there's things like Cleopatra, where there's tons and tons of. I mentioned that film earlier, the Fall of the Roman Empire with Alec Guinness as Marcus Aurelius. Again, just all thousands of real extras. It's brilliant. Love it. And yeah, the battle at the end of Spartacus is among the very, very best. The only one I would even say comes close is Waterloo. That's why I mentioned that. But that's because, again, they got thousands and thousands and thousands of, I think they were like Belarus or Polish or Ukrainian troops. Anyway.
It said Spanish.
Oh, no, for this Spanish, I'm talking about the film Waterloo, where they, again, get thousands of real people to like form square and march along in formation and all sorts of stuff. This is, in Spartacus, one of the very, very best examples of that. It's great. Yeah, it's probably the closest we'll ever get to seeing what it would have actually, you know, really physically looked like in an open plain. Great stuff. Love it.
And Cleopatra has an army the size of the one on stream, but it's just to carry her dress into Rome. Maybe we should cover that one. That would be a laugh as well. But that's a great one. That's also a great one, yeah.
Yeah. I will say that I guess one other thing that stood out for me is because we talked at lengths about the themes of Marxism and the movie. And as we know, this was directed by Kubrick. And, you know, everyone here knows what Kubrick's background was. But I think we can give him a little bit of a pass because another movie we of him, which we covered, was 2001, A Space Odyssey. And, you know, what stood out to me in this movie is what I mentioned at the beginning, that the narrative of the movie, as I interpret it, is that it shows like Rome's civilizational greatness and that all that's illegitimate because of slavery. So, you know, what this would be, I guess, called the slave morality. 2001 of A Space Odyssey, the morality is totally the opposite. The 2001 A Space Odyssey in many ways is a celebration of the achievements of Western civilization. Like there's a scene where it's playing classical music from the 18th century with the spaceships floating around the spacecraft floating towards the space station. So, you know, I find with that Kubrick movie, the message is very much the opposite. And like you mentioned at the beginning that it might have actually been Douglas who had a more of an input on this movie than Kubrick. So I guess we can give him, I don't want to go too hard on the guy because he has made some great movies. And this movie is a fantastic movie despite some of the themes in it. So, but it's interesting you could contrast the two.
Yeah, this is early Kubrick, so he didn't have the clout that he had in Hollywood, and Kirk Douglas would have been a major figure at that point. So Kirk Douglas was driving, calling the shots. But regardless, you can see that just the camera work, the direction, the intelligence of it, it's spot on. I would give Kubrick a bit of a pass as well. I think his work speaks for itself. I mean, and one of the reasons why we don't do his movies that much is because it's been done to death, because It seems at some point he kind of learned some dark things about Hollywood and about elites, and he kind of slipped it into a lot of his films later on, especially. And there's a whole kind of lore behind it and Kubrick, which other people have dedicated their whole channels to covering. And I'm kind of happy, you know, like they've got years and years of like work and sifting through all the little details and all of this. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. I'm not going to pretend to. I'm not going to dip me toe into all of that too much, but yeah. So, and anybody got any roundups before I hit the few super chats that's come in?
No, I think we're good.
All seeing Otto in the chat says, has Morgoth Corey Barry Lynn? No, I haven't even seen it. I don't think, at least not for a long time.
It's very good. It's very good. It's
quite, that's Kubrick as well.
It's slow, I thought, but it's very, very good. It's definitely worth watching. One thing just to round up, perhaps to say, start rounding up for me about this film, is that if you don't get hung up too much on some of the themes and just take it at face value, it's sort of a bit of a ripping yarn, really. It's quite a good story. Don't take it too seriously. If you're one of those people that despises a historical film which diverts from the real history, just sort of get over that a bit and take it for what it is. And if you really want to know what happened, read The Life of Crassus by Plutarch. You can get that just in Penguin paperback for like $8.99 or whatever, or just listen to it on audiobook. I advise people, if they're interested, is to read the real stuff. But I do like this film, despite all its shortcomings. You know, I give it, you know, again, it's part, like we said at the beginning, it's sort of part of my childhood, a bit like Zulu or A Bridge Too Far or something, right? There it is.
It's a fantastic movie, yeah.
I think it's a magnificent movie. It's worth what, I mean, there's so much to enjoy. To be honest, it's worth watching just for Laurence Olivier's performance, because you know how in, like, you get these things where there's people are held up as being like great actors, and you think, are they really though? Were they just kind of astroturfed? And in like these days, I think that is a case. Like, for example, I realize it's cringe to say these days, but I do think Robert De Niro is a great actor. I do. Yeah. And it's kind of, I've got this kind of crisis because a lot of my favorite films have got Robert De Niro in, and he's like this horrible shit there. And you've just got to kind of cope. There's no way around it. But with Laurence Olivier, the little things, the little mannerisms that he does in this make it's such an engaging character. Like, he does little things like when he looks at the person when he's talking to them and he's engaging them, and he does little things like he'll slightly stick his tongue sort of out the, like in his bottom lip, and you think, why is he doing that? And it's all about manipulation. So in this one, as Crassus, he is like a manipulator. He is climbing the ladder of power, and he's very clever. And what he's done is study how to do that, but not be cringe about it, and not be this kind of cackling. You know, he's not Emperor Palpatine. He's much more sophisticated and slick than all of that. And it's great to see that. It's great to see, like, it's an art. Like, it really is elevated. He was mainly like a Shakespearean stage actor. And you can see that, yeah, that is acting done very, very well, like very, very well, where you're just drawn in by his little mannerisms and the way that he says certain things. And it's all so insidious and kind of mesmerized by it. It's great.
Absolutely. Pretty much everything he was in, he's brilliant in. I mean, there's a reason why they made him a peer. They actually made him a lord. I wasn't joking earlier when I said the Lord Olivier, first Baron Olivier. They ennobled him, right? That's rare for just an actor to be made a lord. Yeah, he's absolutely superb. Absolutely brilliant. I also particularly think that Peter Ustinov's very, very good in this. I also think Peter Ustinov is a great actor. Nearly everything he's in, he steals.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a good Hercule Poirot.
Yeah, yeah.
And in this one, you can see that he's such a groveling sycophant, and you know that he hates them, and it's revealed. And you get these great lines, like, I mean, he is like a bit of a dirtbag, because he went along at the final battle just to buy up all the slaves on the cheap. And Crassus kind of welches on the deal and has him lashed out of camp. And you see him go sobbing back to Gracchus. And he's saying, like, I felt something that I hadn't felt before. I think it was dignity. And Crassus got these lines like, oh, dignity, what dignity is very expensive to have in Rome, and all of this kind of thing. There's all these great lines that they've got. It's sophisticated. It's spot on. Yeah. So you can appreciate the movie. It's an absolutely fantastic film. And unfortunately, it does have all of those other things in it, but it is what it is. You know, I'm not, I'm kind of nuanced.
Oh, yeah. Definitely an enjoyable film. I wouldn't deny that.
Piers Brosnan says, Morgoth, will you lads ever review Mike Hodges' classic Get Carter? I may do. You see, when we choose the films, there has to be a lot to sort of dig into and discuss. And I like Get Caught Up, but it's like, okay, what would I? It would be a bit of a nostalgia thing for me, coming from where I come from. So we'll see. I'll give it another watch. But yeah. So let's have a look at what Super Chat. I'm muting myself there. I've got one of Hunky Haggis, which I'll hit first. So for Hunky Haggis, bought a beer on the coffee pot. Oh, I'll check that as well, by the way. And he said, I've seen a big change recently in normies' sympathies to our talking points through mostly funny memes on social media and the undeniable hatred the regime, I think he means, have towards us. Does this give you optimism for the future? Yeah, I suppose it does a bit, but I think that's not new. I think we've been here for a long time, and it's why the ragey, as you put it, is a ragey now and not a regime. It's why they're raging. The regime is raging because it's as if they're sitting on top of this pressure cooker and they've got to clamp down harder, which then disillusions more people. And so we're waiting for some kind of organized leadership to come in and sort this out. But yeah, everybody who's kind of sane gets it to some degree now that things just can't go on like this and there's something not right. Did anybody have any input on that?
That's pretty much my take. One thing I've noticed is that anything that the Canadian mainstream media posts, if it's about immigration or it's about some like woke topic, all of the replies they get on X, all the replies are negatives. And I mean, it's a good sign. So but you know, again, I don't think that's entirely new.
Yeah. I would like to say, I'd like to think that the paradigm either is shifting or has already shifted, the Overton window being scratched back millimeter by millimeter further to the right or away from the extreme left. Yeah, I think so. I think people like Morgoth have done a great deal for it in Britain anyway, at least. Yeah, I actually think that I said it about the Lotus Eaters, that things like the Lotus Eaters are sort of the new avant-garde in a way. It's that the old paradigm used to be that the establishment was conservative with a small c. Small c. Society, the establishment, was right-leaning, and that to be subversive and to be new and hip was to be lefty. That's been the paradigm since since the 60s, really, isn't it? Or even slightly before. I think now, maybe in the last few years, that is or has shifted. That you see loads and loads of Zoomers who are super based. See more and more of it all the time, it seems to me. As Morgoth just said just then, you see, well, and Endeavour, you just see it a lot in, even on Facebook, but on Twitter, you see it loads. I see that the avant-garde, the the counterculture is to be right, is to lean right. I think that is the case. I hope that's not just pure optimism, just pie in the sky, starry-eyed, nowhere near the mark, non-reality take. But I think it is the case that, the counterculture now isn't the left. It's the right, because the left have gone mad in the last 15 odd years, gone absolutely mad, and that the mainstream media just are not liked or trusted anymore. People go to YouTubers. People go to YouTubers for their entertainment and their news, right? Or there's a Facebook group or something like that. I really do think that's the case.
Yeah. And then I'm going to go on. Roddy Murray Films for €2. If you think Crucifixion is bad, look up Brazen Bull.
Oh, I know all about that. That's even worse.
Is that where they put them inside a bowl and burn it? Like, yeah. Boil them up? Yeah.
Being boiled alive, essentially. Yeah.
Nicholas Littlefield for $20. Long time viewer. Just wanted to thanks for the wonderful content, Morgoth. Cheers. Well, thank you very much. Jay for $4.99. Fantastic guest stream. Fantastic guest. Great stream, guys. Okay. Thank you. Mark Hewitt, £2. Thanks, guys. So, yeah, that's where we are. I will say, remember that I'm much more active on Substack than what I am on YouTube these days. So, and most of my stuff is public as well. And I do a little monthly. So if you haven't got time for that, I do a monthly podcast where I read through the month's articles and give a few takes on what's happening on the news and everything like that. So don't forget to sign up for that. What I'm also going to do after this stream, this is the 40th classic movie stream. We've been doing this for like 4 years. I'm at the Substack. I'm going to make a post, and this will go in tonight. And then I'm going to have it where you'll be able to browse all 40 classic movie streams in one place, because it's a bit of a mess, because it's 1 month it's on Endeavor's channel and it's 1 month on mine. So the first 40 streams will all be in one place for your perusal. So that'll be handy for everybody. Everything in there, the epic Rambo streams to 52 Days in Peking, and then the Lawrence of Arabia, that's all there, and all the greats. So, all right. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Bo.
Yeah, no, I just want to say thank you very much for having me. Really, really appreciate it. If ever you want me on again, I will be there in a split second. If you need a history nerd, if you ever do a history-themed one and you want to know about the real stuff, please think of me. I would.
Sure. No problem. It's always a big help.
Definitely. All right. So next month we're on Endeavor's channel. What do you got lined up, Endeavor? Anything?
Well, I have two options, but I don't know whether I want to do a Christmas-themed one or not. The thing is that I kind of want to, but at the same time, I don't know if we have enough in there for it. So I'll think about that.
All right. Okay. Good night, everybody, and I'll catch you later.